An ongoing project at the Aztalan State Park in Jefferson County is trying to solve mysteries about the people who lived there hundreds of years ago while bringing the public and local school kids on board to learn how this kind of work gets done.
Sissel Schrader joins us now in the studio. She's professor of anthropology at UW-Madison and a leader of the project at Aztalan, supported by a recent Baldwin grant. Sissel, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for the invitation to join you.
Well, you've written that Aztalan was a diverse community bringing together a couple of different cultural groups. Who are the people of Aztalan?
They are groups that archaeologists call Late Woodland and Mississippian, and we have a lot of difficulty connecting them with specific descendant communities or tribes that live in the area today, but probably multiple tribes that lived in the area were related to the Late Woodland peoples. Many of the descendant communities related to the Mississippian peoples that lived at the site today live in the southeast, groups like the Creek and the Choctaw, and some Siouan-speaking groups on the Great Plains. And so we think that these two different groups, we see them archaeologically on the basis of different kinds of pottery that they made. They had different technologies for making pottery and different styles that they adopted in the kinds of vessels that they made. They built their houses in different ways as well. And so those are the things that we can access as archaeologists, and we look at those to try and understand something about the behaviors that brought these people together in one location in a way that seems to have been peaceful. So two very different cultural groups, we might call them ethnic groups today, found a way to coexist at this site for several generations.
We'll look into them a little bit more. I wanted to look at the people there today. You're bringing in kind of a diverse group of people to work on and visit these sites at Aztalan. Who have you been reaching out to bring them up close to this work?
Well, that's such a wonderful question. My collaborator, Kelly Tyrell, who is a science writer with UW-Madison, and I have been reaching out to local middle school teachers in Fort Atkinson in particular, and we've talked to some in the Kettle Moraine School District, Milwaukee, areas of the state that maybe don't get as many opportunities to work directly with UW-Madison. And those teachers were really excited about the way this project will be able to draw middle school students into an interdisciplinary study of the past, because the work that we do integrates multiple kinds of skill sets and disciplines. It integrates math skills, history, social studies, art, map making, writing, and, you know, students in middle school have different strengths in these areas, and we think by bringing them together as group learners as part of this project, we'll get them really engaged and allow them to excel in the areas that they have talents and learn more about other areas.
Why did you decide to go with middle school students instead of high school students who might have a little more educational road beneath the tires?
In part, we made that decision because of Act 31, which requires that a certain amount of Native American history be taught at particular benchmark moments in the K-12 process. And middle school students have units on Native American history in the state. And the lesson plans that are available for them to work with really focus on the colonial era and more recent issues that affect Native Americans. And they have limited amounts of curricular materials that deal with the deep history of Native American occupation of this site that goes back more than 12,000 years. And so we really wanted to help augment the kinds of materials that were available.
And you also had public days at the site. I understand you're done working on the site for the season, which is probably okay on a hot day like today. But what happened to these public days?
So on the public days, visitors came. We had opportunities for them to help the students sift through the soil that we were excavating. We excavate in particular areas of the site that we've identified ahead of time using certain technologies like ground penetrating radar and magnetic resistivity, electrical conductivity techniques. And those help us identify places that show lots of soil disturbance in the past. And so we know that those are places where people in ancient times excavated down into the soil to create semi-subterranean houses that would be a little bit cooler on a day like today, a little bit warmer in the winter than would be if they just sort of set them on the ground surface. So we know that we're excavating in areas that are going to be really interesting and rich with information about daily life, that are going to have the garbage that was thrown away, the trash from meals, from, you know, having broken some of their dishes. And so the public was able to help us sift this soil, which is the way we really find things. We find some things as we're excavating with shovels and with sharpened trowels, but a lot of materials we sift all the soil, so we make sure we find everything that's bigger like than a quarter of an inch in size. And it's often those small things that are the most interesting and informative about past behaviors.
How much training do you have to give the public, whether it's a middle school kid or a grown-up, about how to work on a site like this? Because I imagine part of the danger would be you find something that could be kind of priceless and oops, you've whacked it or something.
A lot of what we look at is really fragile. And so the undergraduate students who were part of the project, part of the field work this summer, would work with members of the public for, you know, maybe 10 minutes or so on screening soil and showing them what things look like. So they would see, this is a piece of pottery. And then this, you know, the kids would say, oh, it looked just like dirt to me, or just like soil to me. And then they'd go, but then they'd look at it and they go, I see the difference now. So you'd help them start to recognize what things look like. So we would do some of that. The actual process of excavation is much more, it involves a lot of skills and physical strength that takes a longer time to build up. Our undergraduates take, you know, a couple of weeks before they really have the comfort level at doing the careful excavation. That takes longer to provide training on.
Now, you are doing this as part of a Baldwin grant, I understand. Mm-hmm. And we've talked to a past recipient of that about a public archaeology project in Trempealeau that's bringing the locals there on board. Is this a new way of thinking about archaeology? It's not just something that the experts are doing, it's really sharing with the local community as part of the project?
I think that's always been part of archaeology. There's just something about archaeology that is really intriguing to people. There's something about the tangible nature of touching the past and learning about the past in your own backyard that, it, you know, just people naturally gravitate to those kinds of things. And so there's long been a relationship between archaeologists and the public. But I think what's really expanded over the last 20 years or so is connecting with school children directly. And really, my colleague who's doing the Trempealeau project, Danielle Benden, has also been working on developing some curricular materials for local school children. Just really trying to get kids invested in the history that's in their own place, in their own community. And it gives them a greater sense of belonging to that community when they have an understanding of its place.
What kinds of things have you heard from people when they do sort of get that little jolt that I'm holding something that is ancient in my hand here?
Oh, they usually are, it's usually, this is so cool. or just sort of gasps of like, really? You know, I'm only 10 years old. I can't believe this is so much older than me. And there's also, you know, a lot of what we find is broken. We're digging through the trash of old people, of ancient people. And the broken things, it's difficult sometimes for the students and the public to visualize what that object might have looked like in its original form. And so we try to have pictures out there or have larger pieces of materials that are part of the teaching collection that we have at the university to help them get a better sense of what something looked like. And we talk about the technology, particularly with pottery, because every school kid has had to do that, you know, multiple lessons in building pottery by the coil method. And that's the method, primary method, that was used to make the pottery that we work with. And so it's really easy to get them to start thinking like, it was made just the same way I did, but look at how much finer this old piece is.
Talking to UW-Madison anthropology professor Cecil Schrader, looking at Aztalan, the archaeological site there. The people who are investigating, learning about it today, including middle school students from around Wisconsin, and the people who lived there in the past. And I want to turn more to the past now, Cecil. Part of what you want to do in that area is help bust some myths about Aztalan. And there are a lot of them that I wasn't familiar with.
There are a lot of myths about Aztalan. Probably the biggest one has to do with its name. The name is a Mexican name. It's derived from the Aztec name for their ancestral home that they call Aztlan. And when the site was discovered in the early 1800s, mid-1830s, there was a bestseller kind of book out at that time, which was Baron Alexander von Humboldt's Travels Through Central and South America. And in that volume, he had lavish illustrations of pyramids that were made of stone. But when this Nathaniel Heyer, this person who wrote about the site in 1836, when he saw the earthen mounds at Aztalan, they reminded him of these illustrations of the stone pyramids that he had seen. And he'd read in that book how the Aztecs recounted that their ancestral home lay at the 40th parallel north. And this is kind of close to the 40th parallel north. He didn't question, how do they know that? But he thought he had truly discovered the ancestral home of the Aztecs. And that laid out this persistent narrative that the site was established by ancient Mexican people. And it is an anomalous site in Wisconsin because many of the most visible features at the site are characteristic of the Mississippian migrants who moved into Aztalan. They came probably from Illinois, probably from the St. Louis area. And so it is very different looking for Wisconsin. And so that's really helped, I think, facilitate the persistence of this myth that the site is a place of ancient Mexicans.
Oh, interesting. Are there any other myths that you're looking to bust besides that one?
Well, there's a longstanding myth that the people who lived there were cannibals, and there's no evidence for that either. That's derived from excavations that were conducted in the 1930s, and they found a lot of broken bones, some of which was human. And they didn't think about, well, what are the things that can happen in the ground that can lead to bones being broken in different ways? They just leapt to a conclusion that the bones must have been broken, because sometimes they were found with animal bones, that they must have been broken as part of something related to eating. But animals are sometimes buried with people in the past. So there's a lot of complicated things that relate to that, but we don't see any evidence of that. And there's also been a longstanding myth that because of the wooden walls that were built around the site, that the relationship between the late woodland peoples and the Mississippian peoples was really conflict-laden. And what we're finding is that Mississippian artifacts and late woodland artifacts are commingled. They're found together in the same features, that they are even found in places where it looks like they were very intentionally placed on the floor of a house with a late woodland sherd or pottery vessel placed, and then a Mississippian sherd or vessel placed right on top of it. And those sorts of juxtapositions of material culture that look intentional give us a clue that there's probably a more peaceful relationship between these people. And then we also see that they experimented with one another's technologies of making pottery and styles of making pottery. And the same, it looks like, with houses, the way they built their houses. So that sharing of material practices is something that is most likely going to happen in a more peaceful situation of migrants coming into a community.
You mentioned the mounds, the walls, the houses, and I know there are some recreations up at the site. Can you paint a picture of what this might have looked like if we were able to go back in time and visit Aztalan at its peak?
It would have been perhaps a little like some of the county seats in Wisconsin, where you would have had a square in this case we would call it a plaza, flanked by earthen mounds. And then around that plaza area would be houses. And they probably weren't randomly scattered. They probably were arranged in a somewhat structured manner, but we know from previous work that the entryways faced different directions. And it would have been really well populated. There would have been, 600 or more people living there. So you would have had people running around. You would have had small kitchen gardens next to houses within the site. Outside the wall, there probably were larger gardens. There would have been children, grown-ups interacting, some people making pottery, some people talking. It just would have been a really active place.
So just very briefly as we wrap up, we know you said that these people lived there for at least a few generations. What do we know about what happened to them?
That's a mystery that we don't have good answers to. There are a lot of different factors that were probably involved in the abandonment of the community. And one of those might have been environmental degradation. You have a large concentration of people in a small area cutting down a lot of wood that would be used to build houses and walls, but for fires as well. That may have been a factor. Another factor may have been changing social relationships with other communities. There may have been some climate changes going on around that time. We know that within 100 years of the demise of Aztalan, the climate has gotten cooler, and many peoples have abandoned the upper Great Lakes and moved to the south. And there may have been some breakdown in some of the social relationships within the community.
A lot of mysteries still to solve. Cecil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
A pleasure. Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Cecil Schrader. She's a professor of anthropology at UW-Madison, looking at the ongoing work at the site in Aztalan.